KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, there have been some 75 names for HCM, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a potentially deadly congenital heart condition that afflicts some 1 in 500, and it's the most common form of genetic heart disease. We'll discuss it and talk about controversies over testing for it and look at the best ways to prevent and treat it. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. This hour, we're going to look at a heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which can lead to sudden death during strenuous exercise. And it ought to be noted that in Italy, all young people who are involved in competitive sports actually get an electrocardiogram, and that policy has led to a reported major decrease in sudden cardiac deaths. The most common form of genetic heart disease, and the one that often makes headlines when young athletes die, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, is often detected in competitive athletes and is the most common cause of cardiac death in young people. 44 genes are associated with the condition of HCM, and it can be inherited from either parent. Perhaps most shocking, HCM statistic is that 1 in 500 people have the condition, in which the muscle of the heart is abnormal without apparent cause, and that number is higher than those with HIV or Parkinson's. In this forum hour, we want to focus our attention on hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, which, by the way, has had about 75 names through the years of its medical history. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome here in studio Ewan Ashley. He's an MD and PhD and directs the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford. Good morning to you.
Hi.
Good to have you. And good to have Joshua Davis with us, contributing editor of Wired Magazine, who did an article on HCM in the current issue of Men's Health. Welcome, Joshua Davis.
Good morning, Michael.
And good morning also to Lisa Salberg, who is president and founder of the HCM Association. She joins us this morning by phone from Rockaway, New Jersey. And welcome, Lisa Salberg.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we ought to mention that Lisa Salberg has HCM, and so does her daughter. So there's a personal history here. I guess one of the things we ought to get right into with you, Lisa Salberg, is the symptoms. And unfortunately, there are no real warning signs, and this is what makes this kind of difficult for many people, although there can be shortness of breath or palpitation, those kinds of things, chest pain and so forth. But since we're talking about 1 in 500 people having the condition, often maybe the best thing to do is to really go out and get tested.
Well, that sounds very easy, but it's not quite so easy because testing is laborious and time-consuming and, frankly, expensive. So first round, what you want to do is you want to look for signs or symptoms or family history of heart disease. And the signs and symptoms you mentioned, chest pain, shortness of breath, palpitations, fainting, nearly fainting, or a feeling of fatigue can all be associated with HCM. But if you look at your family history and look for family members who have had cardiac problems, pacemakers that have been implanted kind of young, maybe that can be an indicator in some, or family members who just, quote, drop dead under the age of 50, even if it was a generation ago, you want to pay attention to those things. And if any of those things exist, then yes, absolutely get to a cardiologist and get a workup, get an echocardiogram, an EKG, and talk to your doctor about the signs and symptoms and family history, and then we'll be able to identify more people. Unfortunately, though, not everybody has symptoms.
Well, EKGs, from what I understand, can spot it, really. In fact, I know you took your daughter when she was about 7. I read in Josh's article about 90% of the time. But the problem is, in fact, the AMA recently published something about this in March there goes someone's phone. EKG testing in terms of national programs just cost prohibitive, at least what we're reading from the AMA.
That's the way they're reporting it at this point. There are some logistical problems with mass EKGs. Pediatricians' offices do not normally have EKG machines, nor are they adept at reading EKGs on a regular basis. And there can be a lot of normal variants, I'm sure Dr. Ashley can comment on that, that may not actually need to be worked up, but we might actually be able to start catching some things. I personally would like to see all young people, regardless of physical activity or involvement in competitive athletics, get baseline EKGs during adolescence so that hopefully we can identify those who have something abnormal there and at least have the opportunity to follow up on it.
Well, this is often identified with athletics, but as many people who are not involved in athletics seem to have the problem as well. I mean, it's across the board, isn't it?
Well, 1 in 500 people in the general population are going to have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And yes, there are a large number of those people who participate in competitive athletics, but just as many non-athletes die every year from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy as athletes, if not more. A lot of times when you have HCM, you become deselected by virtue of your inability to run as fast as the other kids. That's my issue when I was a kid. I got cut from JV softball because I couldn't run as fast as everybody else. Little did they understand why. So we can't just look at the athletes, although they're very important, and we have this opportunity normally through pre-participation screening physicals to isolate them, and we should maximize that opportunity. It's not the only place to catch kids. We need to catch them in the doctor's office, and we need to come up with something in this country that takes care of our children's hearts better than we're doing right now.
Lisa Sahlberg again is with us from Rockaway, New Jersey. She's president and founder of HCM Association, and you and Ashley here in studio directs the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford. It's so often associated, Dr. Ashley, this condition with intense exercise. And in fact, I guess the AMA has been saying that maybe people ought to, particularly with this condition, really ought to back off from intense exercise. What does it say to the lay public, though, particularly since it has such a high incidence, 1 in 500? About exercise.
Well, I think that avoidance of high-intensity exercise is one of the first things we'll say to all our patients when they have a first diagnosis. And that really comes from the idea that most of the sudden cardiac deaths that happen in sport from this condition happen in that high-intensity exercise. There's a number of different possible reasons why that might be. High levels of the fight-or-flight hormones, very high heart rates, and it's an extra stress on the system. But as I think we'll come to later, the Italian experience has shown that simply excluding people from the high-intensity exercise is enough actually to save a lot of lives in this condition.
There's no genetic testing for this available?
There is genetic testing, yeah. In fact, from two different companies, and we regularly will send our patients blood for genetic tests. I think it was really in the early 1990s and then through that decade that we discovered the genetic basis for the disease. Prior to that, it was a disease that was described entirely in anatomical terms. But I think there was some disappointment that happened through that period as we realized that the identification of the genes was not going to give us something that would help the individual patient sitting in front of us. So it wouldn't allow us to say, well, you have this particular gene, therefore you're at risk of this particular symptom, or you're at particular risk of a dangerous heart rhythm. What it does do, though, is allow us to do much more significant family screening. So if we identify the gene in one individual, rather than have their family members come back every year for screening with an ultrasound of the heart or an EKG, we can actually do a much more definitive one-time blood test. So the genetic testing has really beginning to make a really significant change.
As I said in the introduction, about 44 genes now associated with the condition.
Yeah, well, one or two genes, in fact, make up almost all of the cases that we currently understand. Certainly 70% are explained by one of those two genes. The current panel of testing is somewhere between 5 and 8 genes, but most of our patients find the mutated gene with testing the first 5.
So let's talk about what they've done in Italy, because they have all young people who are involved there in competitive sports get an electrocardiogram. And again, this policy has apparently led to a fairly significant decrease in terms of sudden cardiac deaths.
Yeah, the Italian data is really spectacular in the sense that they have an almost 90% decrease in sudden cardiac death. But there's a number of caveats to that, and the Italian data is not readily applicable in an identical fashion to the U.S. experience. One of the reasons is that the most common cause of sudden cardiac death in Italy is not the same as the most common cause here in the United States. And here in the United States, it's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. About 40% of cases are caused by that. In Italy, about 20% of cases, that being the leading cause, is something called arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, which is a much more rare form affecting the right-hand side more of the heart of cardiomyopathy.
Talking with you and Ashley, who is an MD and PhD and directs the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Harvard, I ought to mention here that There was a study done by the AMA in which they released a scientific statement saying that though physical exercise is widely advocated by the medical community, sometimes it can increase early death risk. And there was also a study by the AMA, Dr. Ashley, that found that joggers in Rhode Island were almost 8 times more likely to die early. And this is certainly significant.
Yeah, I think that's also fascinating. And I mean, exercise is represents what you might call a risk protection paradox, or it's sometimes been known as that, in that we've known even as from the early 1950s, a classic study done by Jeremy Morris on the London bus drivers, who he compared the bus drivers with the bus conductors. And these two groups were very similar in their environment and in their recruitment. The only difference really being that one was sedentary all day and one was up and down stairs and walking around the bus. And he found that the cardiovascular mortality in the conductors was significantly less than that of the bus drivers. And in Joshua's article, he mentioned Ralph Pathenberger's work with the San Francisco longshoremen that showed a very similar thing, that the people who had active jobs lived less. So there's really a great deal of evidence, not only for obesity or high blood pressure, cholesterol, but also in other places where you wouldn't expect. For example, exercise reduces the risk of prostate cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, reduces cognitive decline in the elderly, and even depression. So there are a number of benefits of exercise. On the other hand, it is actually true that during the period you're exercising, you're stressing the heart, and your risk does go up for that period of time.
So make people very chary about doing intense exercise.
Well, I think the key is doing regular exercise. There are certain studies have looked specifically at this point, and what they find is that the people who exercise 5 times a week are at only very minor risk for that short period that they're exercising. In fact, they never reach back to their earlier risk of being a sedentary person. Whereas if you're somebody who exercises once every month and you suddenly get up and run around, and then your risk is very significantly greater, probably somewhere around that 5 to 10 range.
Again, Ewan Ashley directs the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford. Joshua Davis is contributing editor of Wired Magazine, also did an article on HCM in the current issue of Men's Health. And what brought him to this article was the death of a friend, a very close friend.
Yeah, my friend Bill.
Goggins?
Bill Goggins, who was an editor at Wired as well and in fact was my running partner. And him and I would run together probably, I would say, 2 to 3 times a week. So not sure whether we're fitting that demographic or not. But he was always a much, much better runner than I was. He was always a step ahead, and he was always pushing me to run faster. And then he decided to run the San Francisco Marathon last July 30th. And I decided not to run with him. I'd run one marathon before, and it really hurt. So I figured, you know what? I don't need to do that again. But Bill had never run one before. And I kept calling him after the race and saying, you know, leaving messages, how'd you do? I want to know how you did. You know, he wasn't returning my calls. And I thought maybe he didn't do as well as he had hoped. And it turns out that he, in fact, had died at mile 24.
And you went and got an autopsy.
I got his autopsy,
yeah.
Because for months, you know, the newspapers reported that there was some kind of cardiac problem, but nobody specified what it was. And so all of us, all of his friends were wondering, you know, how did this guy who we thought was perfectly healthy, who in fact was in the best shape of his life, why did he die? And so about 6 months after he did die, I got his autopsy report, and it said...
You had to get family permission.
I got his family permission to do it, and it said very simple terms, this word I'd never heard before. It's, you know, it doesn't really roll off the tongue very well. Hypertrophic cardio what? You know, and I typed it into Google and slowly learned that it's this this disease that affects many, many people. And the hard part about it is that quite frequently the first symptom is sudden death. So how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, you can read about it as you've done and as I've done, and you can, you know, feel the sense of trepidation creeping over you about doing intense exercise. I mean, cardiac arrest is about 25 times higher from what I've seen in terms of statistics. That sound about right to you, Ewan Ashley, and for those who do high activity as opposed to those who do lighter activity or rest?
I think overall the data would suggest that maybe 2 times is closer. But during that period of exercise, when you're in the high-intensity exercise, the estimates have ranged anything from 2 to 50 times over the years.
So, Joshua Davis, now, again, in your article in Men's Health, you get into, well, really the specifics of this condition that you had to look twice before you typed into Google and all that. And there we've been talking kind of on the edges of whether or not there ought to be mandatory testing or to what extent it's appropriate to put athletes through the kind of testing and so forth. And you get into some real questions here, which you bring up in your article. I mean, there's a gold medal winner in Italy who was then barred from participation from future Olympics because he had HCM. And you would think, wouldn't that be his choice? I mean, in fact, I think you say in your article, you'd rather have your friend alive.
Well, I would rather have my friend alive, but if Bill had been told that he couldn't run, and running was part of who he was, he ran, you know, I only ran with him two or three times a week. He ran pretty much every day, and it was kind of how he viewed his everyday life. So if somebody had said to him, you can't run, I think he might have said, I'll take the risk. You know, I don't know. It's tough to guess, but it does get into some deeper questions about personal choice versus collective health. You know, with athletes, particularly professional athletes, it's not just about their choice. They're performing almost for us. And so should we allow them to do that if they are at an increased risk of dying while they're doing it? Is it really just their choice, or do we bear some responsibility for their health?
That's a very tough and vexing moral question.
Michael, may I add something to that?
Lisa Solberg.
There are two or three other ways to look at this. Number one, we have to deal with adults versus adolescents and truly informed consent. If a patient is an adult and understands all the risks and has been advised by the doctor what he or she should or should not do and what those risks might be, that's one set of criteria to be evaluated, and the individual has to make a choice that's right for their life and do so with true informed consent. In the case that we're dealing with a child or a minor, the whole scope changes. It is a parent's responsibility to protect a child, and the child really cannot provide, in my opinion, truly informed consent to participate, and the school systems hold some responsibility there for who is and is not allowed to participate, and there has been legal action on that front throughout the country a number of times.
But parents can act in the benefit of their children by screening them if they're young athletes.
Right? Absolutely, they can. Where you do run into a bit of a problem is a parent who has a child who's diagnosed, and the parent decides that they want the child to still continue to participate. Believe it or not, I hear that one much more often than you'd think. So it's not a very easy answer. Yes, you have a disease. No, you can't play. There is a huge emotional toll on young adolescent males specifically, and we need to be aware that these kids who are diagnosed need the support of their community and their teams after diagnosis as well, because they will not be able to participate in sports if they're a child diagnosed with HCM.
Well, there's more problem with boys then, you're saying, too.
Well, my experience at the HCMA, now we've dealt with thousands of families with HCM. Adolescent males have the hardest time adjusting to being told no sports. Girls seem to be a little bit more accepting and find alternative activities. Not that they're not as devastated to be taken away from competitive athletics, but it doesn't define them as much as it tends to define a young male. So emotionally, I've seen a much more significant impact from young males being pulled out of football, soccer, or basketball than a girl being told, no, she can't play field hockey or softball. But there is still an emotional attachment there. And if you look at the data, and Ewan can probably speak more specifically on this, while you do see young girls dying from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy on the athletic field, it's a scant number in comparison to the male athletes that die.
Yeah, that certainly conforms to the statistics I've seen. And Dr. Ashley, I presume you would also...
Yeah, it's about 10 to 1, actually, is the ratio.
What about specific sports, though? The American Heart Association put out a table. I mean, there is a way of kind of gauging which sports are more risky, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that table was put together by a group of experts, and using their knowledge of the disease and their knowledge of those sports, they came up with a recommendation. So we use that with all our patients who come around. The recommendation is really based on the data that we have, which says that most of the sudden cardiac deaths happen in the high-intensity sports, but there's also a participation level that you have to subtract for that. So we see it most in basketball and in American football in this country, and then in soccer. But, of course, in countries where there is less basketball and less American football, in Europe, for example, soccer deaths are the most common.
I know there are many people out there wondering what you can do for this condition. Defibrillators is one thing that's done, certainly, but you can actually cut away the thickness. Can you explain this to us anatomically? Because there's a thickness of the wall that separates the chambers of the heart.
Right, exactly. And so the disease is characterized by this excessive thickening, and it causes a few different problems. One of them is that the excessive thickening of the wall between the chambers can actually block the blood flow coming out of the heart. And that leads to a buildup of pressure behind that thickening, which we would call a gradient. And that in itself can cause symptoms for the patient. Also, that those changes can lead to a stiffening of the heart, and that can cause very high pressures in the lungs, and that can cause shortness of breath. And then finally, as we've been discussing, the chaotic organization of the muscle fibers can actually predispose to dangerous rhythms. So in terms of treatment, the dangerous rhythms, as we said, for many years we had really no treatment for it. The medical therapy, the tablets have made really no difference to sudden death there. The implantation of a defibrillator has made a huge difference, and we have some new data that we really are saving lives with that. But then for the patients who have this buildup of pressure in their heart from the thickening of the heart muscle wall, then there are different techniques, and the gold standard really is a surgical technique where we actually cut out the thickness of the wall.
What have you discovered, Joshua Davis, through your research about really identifying susceptible people and finding out who is at risk for this?
Well, it comes down to a question of how much testing you're going to do across the general population. In Italy, they test all competitive athletes. And we're not just talking professional athletes. We're talking anybody who wants to run a marathon, anybody who wants to compete in a high school athletic team. And when you test across the board and you identify the people who have the condition and you remove them from that athletic endeavor, the Italians have shown that they've seen a 90% decrease in deaths as a result of HCM, which is mind-boggling. And so the obvious question is, why don't we do that? It would make sense. We want to save lives.
The AMA says it's too costly and too impossible.
They say it's not practical, but you know, you're always faced with the question, what is a life worth?
Well, one of the things that struck me about this is, why, when this is so prevalent, is it so unknown?
Well, it's so unknown because the first symptom is so often sudden death. It's kind of a mysterious killer. You may have panic attacks, you may have anxiety, and you may think that's just mental or normal. But in fact, it's this condition. The symptoms are not always so evident. And so as a result, people go undiagnosed. And even in the case, it's also just becoming, I would say, more widely understood and more widely known right now. And in previous generations, a family member, you know, maybe there was an uncle who died while driving on a freeway at night suspiciously, and nobody can explain why.
Lisa Sahlberg, we're coming up on a break here, but I think what you and the HCM Association are advocating here is maybe screening all children, and the baseline age to shoot for would be about 12.
Well, we would hope that the healthcare system in the United States would lend itself to screening children's hearts better during adolescence, at earliest age 12. It's a pretty big step to take because our healthcare system has many flaws in it. But as we move towards healthcare reform, I'm hoping that we will see something put in place that we can check our children's hearts better and look for the most common misdiagnoses in HCM, which are athletically induced asthma, mitral valve prolapse, and panic attacks, in our experience.
Well, let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. Any questions or comments you may have, indeed, we welcome your phone calls. And whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join this program toll-free. Our number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free. Lines are open to you, 866-733-6786. You can also send us an email. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Talking about the heart condition, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which can lead to sudden death during strenuous exercise. With us, Ewan Ashley, MD and PhD and director of the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford, and Joshua Davis, contributing editor of Wired, who did an article on HCM in the current issue of Men's Health, and Lisa Sahlberg by phone from Rockaway, New Jersey, president and founder of the HCM Association. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about a heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It actually afflicts about 1 in 500, and it can lead to sudden death during strenuous exercise. And talking about that whole paradox also about when you do exercise, and you need to do exercise certainly to stay cardiac healthy. I was talking a little bit off air, in fact, with Dr. Ashley and Josh Davis about when my father had his first heart attack, and a friend of mine, Ken Gershengorn, was his attending cardiologist, main cardiologist, along with Brian Strunk. And he said, your father did hard labor his whole life. And I said, yes, you know, you could tell. I mean, he was a factory worker. He said that saved his life with that first heart attack. And we've often been on this trajectory of looking at hard labor and looking at good exercise as a way of protecting the heart, especially intense and strenuous exercise. And now we learn more about HCM. You know, it's frightening a lot of people. A lot of people think, you know, maybe I'm putting myself at risk. I could just have this first symptom and keel over dead. Some thoughts on that? I mean, that's the paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, and well, I think the important thing is that it's a very, very small subset, even of the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patient population that are at increased risk of sudden cardiac death. So I think an important point is that most patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy actually live a normal lifespan. And that's one of the first things I'll tell any of our patients.
Including doing intense exercise.
Well, but after we make the diagnosis, we will recommend they do no more than a 6 out of 10 intensity on their exercise. And so one of the key interventions we do, arguably the most important intervention we do, is to prevent them from doing intense exercise when we make the diagnosis. But just before that, I'll have told them that most patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy will live a normal lifespan.
Let me go to our caller. Sandy, you're first up here. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I had a ASD diagnosed 2 years ago that at 38 years old, after doing a mini triathlon, that I had no idea that a simple EKG diagnosed it. So I couldn't play sports in high school as well, but just thought I wasn't athletic enough.
I'm sorry?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Oh, I was just saying that I had a PhD defect diagnosed 2 years ago after doing a triathlon. Mm-hmm. That as a kid, I was born with it and needed open heart surgery at 38 years old. Mm. That could have been avoided with a EKG when I was much younger and unable to. I tried to play soccer in high school and just couldn't make it across the field.
It's just too bad, Lisa Solberg, when we hear that kind of case, because it would have been so easily avoided at an early age. You took your daughter, what, when she was 7 for testing? Lisa Solberg? Danny, you want to bring up her volume?
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You took your daughter in at 7, I believe, didn't you?
Well, actually, I took my daughter in much earlier than that. My family history is I've lost 4 family members to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, an uncle at the age of 48, grandfather at 43, aunt at 52, and my sister at 36. I was diagnosed when I was young myself, so from the time my daughter was born, we were checking her periodically. We found out her genetic status when she was 7. But when you're talking about a young athlete who wants to participate in a sport but cannot do it, does not have the physical endurance to do it, can't run fast enough, can't catch their breath, mom and dad, get this kid to a doctor, get them checked out young. Don't just think that they're lazy or they just don't have the want.
Well, but unfortunately, we also have an epidemic of childhood obesity, so you have a lot of kids who are overweight who are having problems because of that, right?
Well, they should be at the doctor, too, but for a different reason. We should be working on that obesity problem as well. But for that child athlete who is out there trying to compete but just can't do it, and if you've been in the situation, you know what I'm talking about. You're running and you're pushing your legs as fast as you can, but for some reason they're not moving as fast as the people next to you, and they're leaving you behind. If that's your case, talk to your doctor.
And again, Lisa Solberg is president and founder of the HCM Association. And let me go to more calls. Julia, good morning.
Good morning. I am a patient of Dr. Ashley's. Hello, Dr. A.
Hello.
And a member of Lisa's organization, the HCMA. One of the things I wanted to bring up is about genetic testing. I know that I have this disease. I'm employed right now, and I have insurance. My concern is for testing my children. We've had echocardiograms, but we haven't done the genetic testing, and I'm a little worried about that because I'm afraid they haven't entered the workforce yet, and I'm afraid that they'd be denied insurance going forward. I'll take any comments.
Okay.
I'd be happy
Lisa
to.
Lisa Solberg, I thought you might want to jump in here, please.
Yeah. Right now, I urge you all, as soon as this program is done, to get on the telephone and call Senator Coburn's office in Oklahoma and ask him to take his senatorial hold off the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, which is pending at the United States Senate right now. When Gina, the genetic non uh, Genetic Information Discrimination Act passes, which God willing it will, your children will be protected against discrimination on their genetic status. For more information on Gina, you can visit the HCMA's website at www.4hcm.org. The House has already passed it. The Senate passed it twice before. Right now, Senator Coburn of Oklahoma is holding it, even though he voted for it twice before. So please call Coburn's office and ask him to put Gina to the floor for a vote and take his hold off of it.
And let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls from Belmont. Iris, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering if the panel could address other triggers for cardiomyopathy crises. My son had a heart attack at 23, which was triggered by previously undiagnosed cardiomyopathy. And at the time, we were told that it was probably due to a virus or maybe alcohol use. And I have also read that pregnancy can trigger cardiomyopathy crises. So I'm wondering if the panel could talk about triggers other than intense exercise.
What do we know about other triggers, you and Ashley?
Well, I think that there are different kinds of cardiomyopathy, and this is one of the things the caller is referring to. And the hypertrophic form, of course, as we've been talking, refers to a thickening of the heart muscle. But there's another kind of cardiomyopathy where the heart chamber becomes dilated, and in fact, the walls of the heart become very thin. And this, I think, is the kind of cardiomyopathy that the caller's son was diagnosed with. Of all the causes of cardiomyopathy, about half are caused by coronary artery disease, so blockages in the arteries that supply the blood and oxygen to the heart. And when we say heart attack, we are often referring, even when doctors use the term, we're often referring to that, a blockage in a heart and in a blood vessel. We also use the term cardiac arrest, which is really what we're talking about here, when somebody would drop down suddenly with a dangerous rhythm, for example, and perhaps die or perhaps be resuscitated. The different causes of the dilated cardiomyopathy are, as the caller mentioned, viruses can cause them, although it's very hard to pin down a virus, as many of us know. There can be a particular form that comes on around the time of the late part of pregnancy or the early part, post-labor, called peripartum cardiomyopathy. And then alcohol and other toxic substances, even some chemotherapies, can cause this dilated cardiomyopathy. So really there are a large number of different causes and a very broad spectrum of that cardiomyopathy as a weakness of the heart muscle can present.
There's a listener named Christina says, please comment on the use of the so-called stress test by cardiologists in light of the real possibility that the patient may be susceptible to sudden death because of a hidden heart condition.
So for many years, we hesitated to use stress tests in some certain patient populations because of that risk. There really are almost no patients in whom we don't do the full stress test now because there's very great deal of information that can be gained from it. And at the end of the day, the stress test occurs in hospital with licensed personnel and a physician present or a nurse or exercise physiologist present. So, and we routinely will do a stress test on our patients, both those who've had heart attacks and those who have cardiomyopathy. And one of the reasons is to give them, especially the post-heart attack patients, to give them the confidence to go out and exercise themselves, because what they really need to do is exercise. And also for the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients, although we do recommend against the high-intensity exercise, they're at the same risk of this coronary artery disease as other people. And so we don't want them to sit and be sedentary and become obese and be hypertensive. What we want them to do is exercise, but just keep away from the very high-intensity exercise.
You and Ashley, again, is director of the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford. Here's another listener, Valerie, who says, my boyfriend was diagnosed with this condition at age 22, and the doctors prescribed beta blockers. Can you speak about the benefits and danger of using these?
Certainly. The beta blockers are really the most common class of medications that we use for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that we don't have a medicine that can really provide a cure for the disease. What we're really doing is trying to reduce some of the symptoms for the disease, and in particularly in those patients who have the blockage of blood coming out of the heart and the buildup of pressure, what we call the gradient, then the beta blockers can be particularly useful. They sort of calm the heart down and make the contraction a little less severe, and they can actually reduce that buildup of pressure within the heart.
Joshua Davis, I wondered if in your research you found, we've been talking, or we've heard certainly a disproportionate number of male athletes, are there any statistics that we should be apprised of with respect to race or demographics, region, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, I know that there are some very sensitive issues in regards to race and the condition, particularly in the NBA. This has become a point where
Was it Len Bias who died of it?
There's been a number of them. The most recent high-profile discussion on the issue was with Eddie Curry,
right,
who played for the Chicago Bulls and was flagged as a potential HCM candidate. But it wasn't 100%. And so they were in contract negotiations, and they suggested, the Bulls management said, why don't we do some genetic testing? And this got into the issue of, okay, they do the genetic testing and it says you have a 50% chance of dying from this. So therefore, we're not going to renew your contract. Is that really kind of peering into the future and trying to judge somebody by what might happen? He ended up getting traded to the Knicks and continues to play. But so many of the players in the NBA are African-American and are diagnosed with this condition. And so there is a sentiment within that community that it's kind of pointing the finger at that community unjustly.
Let me take more of your calls. And Kathy joining us. Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
Who is this?
I'm sorry?
Hi. Hello. Is this Michael?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Are we on the air right now?
Yes, you are. You're
on
the air.
I'm so sorry. I didn't understand. I'm Bill Goggins' sister. I'm Kathy Goggins, Bill's younger sister, and I live here in the area. I wanted to thank, obviously, Josh Davis for writing this article and for helping our family bring light to the situation with Bill. And I wanted to thank the doctors, of course, because awareness is incredible. I'm going to myself be tested and probably have my kids get tested, but ironically, we did have an uncle that was driving on the highway in the middle of the night and died inexplicably in a car accident, and his name was also Bill Goggins, my dad's brother. Pat Goggins is our dad, and his brother died at age 53. So I'm really appreciative to hear all the information and just wanted to thank all of you for the excellent program.
Well, thank you for that, and very kind of you. Your brother was about 53, I believe, wasn't he?
He was 43.
Oh, 43, I'm sorry.
Yeah, my uncle was 53 and Bill was 43, and I'm 42 myself, so I'm a year younger than Bill.
Well, again, thanks for the call, and glad you're getting tested and getting your kids tested, Kathy.
Yes, thank you so much for letting everyone know about it.
Appreciate your call. Thank you again. And on we go to more calls. Tricia, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning. Tricia, are you there? Going once for Tricia or no? Okay. Let me go to Ian then on a cell phone. Good morning, Ian.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My question was, I'm a firefighter, full-time professional firefighter, and I was wondering if any studies have been done in reference to this disease and occupations, but more specifically mine as a firefighter, because at any time we could be going from a deep sleep, 10 minutes later we're, you know, working at 100%+.
Yeah, I've got an email here from a listener who says that I read the email before, who has a condition, her boyfriend, he is now 32 and remains physically active and leads a normal life. He, however, had to stop being a firefighter. Dr. Ashley, what about firefighting? We're going to talk about it tomorrow, in fact, on forum.
Well, I think firefighting is in the same, obviously, category as high-intensity exercise. It is effectively high-intensity exercise, and we have had patients over the years who have wanted to go into firefighting who've been diagnosed with the disease and not been able to do it. The question of screening then is a difficult one, and I think we're back then to the same thing that we were talking about in relation to the governing bodies of the sports and whether there's actually a screening protocol that's official. At the moment, we haven't talked about it yet, but there is the current screening protocol is really a 12-point questionnaire and then a physical carried out by a medical member of staff. And I think I would advise that if we actually have it put up on our Stanford Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy website, if anyone wants to take a look at it, that they can actually go and see if you have any of those symptoms, then you should be checked out. And I think although there aren't any firefighter guidelines, or not that I'm aware of, specific ones in relation to screening at this stage, then it's potentially an issue for the future that we should consider.
Well, let me thank Ian for the call. And before I go to more calls, I want to go to another email from Robert, who says, your guest mentioned they recommend that people with HCM exercise at a lower level. I'm wondering if breathing during aerobic exercise can be used as a gauge of how hard someone with HCM is exercising, and if so, would the ability to hold a conversation while exercising be a good level, or is there some other good rule of thumb?
That's an excellent rule of thumb, and it's one we use ourselves in our clinic. If people these days, heart rate monitors are very widely available, and so we will actually we'll have people use those, and we'll have them come in and do an exercise test, and we'll give them some indication of the heart rate range that they should be going in. But that's a very practical and useful piece of advice.
And our next caller joining us from Hood River, Oregon, is Greg, I guess, listening to us on Sirius. Good morning.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Gentlemen, I'm an environmental toxicologist, and I've been involved in research on a variety of contaminants and their effects. And one of the things I ran across while I was doing my research was the effect of beta blockers on one of your detoxification systems. And the way I came across this was the lab director that I was working with had been in pretty good health, but he'd had slightly had high blood pressure, and his doctor recommended him taking beta blockers. Well, this gentleman was also a woodworker, and once he started taking the beta blockers, his health completely crashed. And according to what my research says, it appeared that the beta blockers, by stopping this detoxification system, basically opened him up to being poisoned by the chemicals he was working with. So my recommendation with you guys to be very careful with your beta blockers as a prescription for these people. Anyway, I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, and we thank you for the call. Dr. Ashley, beta blockers and toxicity?
Well, it's an interesting point. We've actually been moving away a little bit in the general population, for example, in the group of patients with high blood pressure from the use of beta blockers. And some of the effects we thought were formerly very dramatic have, I think, been shown in retrospect to be not quite so dramatic. But there are certain populations in whom there's still very clear benefit after a heart attack, for example, is one. I mentioned in the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy population, then we don't have benefit for a reduction in the death rate, but we definitely have data for reductions in symptoms using them. There are side effects from beta blockers for sure. They make many patients feel tired, but many patients derive significant benefit from them.
And on we go to Sherman, Texas. Mark, also listening on Sirius, are you?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I was wondering if there are any other heart rhythm abnormalities that mirror these kinds of symptoms that are more benign. And I'll take my answer off the air if that was clear.
Okay. Lisa Solberg, can you help us here?
Actually, I would point that one back to Dr. Ashley.
All right. So be it.
Yeah. So one of the things, we talk a lot about the athletic heart, and so we have a number of patients who come to the clinic, and the question has arisen, do they have an athlete's heart or do they have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? And it's not just that there's a very small amount, less than 10%, in fact, actually contrary to popular belief of thickening with the athlete's heart, but athletes actually have little extra beats more so than non-athletes. And these extra beats are benign in that case, but sometimes they can also run together so that several of these beats will run together. And that is a rhythm that in athletes is benign, but that can be a harbinger of more negative findings in patients.
Well, so naturally, we're getting a lot of questions about medical specifics with you here, you and Ashley. And here's one from a listener who says, I'm wondering if there's any hope for HCM patients offered by some of the new angiogenesis therapies currently in the works to treat heart disease. I just heard some encouraging results from Cardium's agent, but it was a different patient population, elderly women with angina. Could promoting new blood vessel growth offer a potential cure for the underlying condition in a way that beta blockers can't?
Well, it's a good question. The issue with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, though, is one of the heart muscle and not so much of the heart arteries. There are issues with the heart arteries, especially the small ones where they become thickened, and that can cause chest pain. We've been talking about that as one of the potential symptoms. But the underlying deficit in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is with the muscle. So what we're doing is looking to the muscle for a potential cure if it will ever come. And I think the fact that we've laid out the genetic basis of the disease over the course of the last 10 or 15 years really lays the foundation for us to go ahead and start looking at potential genetic therapies at some time in the future.
And we'll bring on another caller from Sedalia, Kentucky. Curtis, I think another serious caller. Good morning.
Yes.
That is S-I-R-I-U-S.
Good afternoon.
Yes, sir.
I tuned in late, so I apologize if you've already covered this information, but I was wondering, is there a standard rule of determining proper heart rate during, like, aerobic exercise? I've always used 220 minus my age times 0.85 kind of as a target. Is there a better target that you know of?
Well, that's, again, a good question. We touched on it just briefly earlier, but 220 minus your age is this equation you'll see in many gyms and in other places as a kind of guess at your maximum heart rate. There is a very wide variation between individuals, though, so sometimes I would veer away from that and, if possible, actually measure your maximal heart rate if it can be measured under controlled conditions. But there's also much more simple and very practical ways of doing this. We touched on one earlier, which was if you can hold a conversation at the same time, then you're probably exercising at a reasonable rate, not too high intensity. I've actually found that many patients are pretty good at guessing on a one to ten scale how intense their exercise is. And so we would ask people to keep it below 6 out of 10 patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
And I thank the caller, Curtis. Thanks for calling. Another sort of numerical measure point that I came across is this 1.5 centimeters. If the thickening is at 1.5 centimeters of the heart muscle, I mean, I don't know what this does for patients, but that's really a key.
Yeah, I think that is really an area over which it's very unusual to find an athletic heart. So normal would be up to about 1 centimeter, basically. And severe athletic training and rowing, cross-country skiing, these kind of exercises are perhaps more than any others the ones that cause the heart to be a little thicker. But it's by about a millimeter, so between 0.8 and 0.9 is a sort of normal athletic response. A small number of athletes can go up into the 1 to 1.5 range, and we call that the grey area for obvious reasons. And those people need to be followed or tested in some cases, and Joshua mentioned this in his article, they need to be benched, because the only way to be really definitive about whether it's athletic hypertrophy or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is to stop them exercising. Above 1.5, though, it's pretty unlikely that benching someone will actually lead to the reduction of the wall thickness.
Now, listener Bill from Auckland says, what's the difference between HCM and long QT?
So a big difference, although there's there's are some overlap in terms of the dangerous rhythms that can happen. HCM is the thickening of the heart muscle caused by a mutation in one of the proteins that codes for the muscle contraction machinery. Long QT is actually a condition. The QT refers to a finding on the EKG, the electrocardiogram, so the distance between the Q wave and the end of the T wave, and it can be long, can also predispose to dangerous rhythms and sudden cardiac death, but it's caused by a mutation in a particular ion channel in the heart, so the electrical instability of the heart, usually not with muscle thickness.
Again, Ewan Ashley is both MD and PhD and director of the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Stanford, and Joshua Davis wrote about HCM in the current issue of Men's Health. You have some concerns, Joshua, about well, the questionnaire that's put out by the AHA, first of all, tell us what it is and tell us why your concerns are.
There are different versions of it across the country, but basically the current recommendation from the Heart Association is to essentially give high school students, for instance, a questionnaire saying, you know, do you feel shortness of breath? Has there been any instance of sudden death in your family? And I think a kid who wants to be on the team is going to be able to game the questionnaire pretty easily. They're going to know that if they say, yes, I feel shortness of breath, they're not going to make the team, so they're not going to answer it appropriately. So I think the questionnaire is not an effective method, and it's going to lead to more deaths on the field.
What would be a more effective
method? The only effective method that I can see is across-the-board EKG testing. And then we get back to this issue of cost. And are you going to require a greater hurdle for people to participate in sports? And if they can't afford it, then is that there's some social justice issues there? And kids who can't afford it aren't going to compete? You know, so it's a very complicated question. The Italians get around it because they have universal health coverage.
It's also a complicated question when you start, as we've noted, start getting into symptoms and how to determine. Again, there's a gender difference that ought to be noted here, Ewan Ashley. I mean, from my understanding, women don't tend to get the chest pains as much as men do in terms of initial symptomatology.
So certainly men and women will present in different ways, and particularly with coronary artery disease, we find recently, as we've paid more attention to it over the last few years, that women really present in a different way. Because hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is such a rare disease, those kind of studies haven't really been done yet for this disease, but I think we always need to be aware of the fact that patients will present in different ways. I think the EKG screening is a very interesting area, and it's a very interesting area partly because the Europeans have a document that would suggest in one direction that this is something, an aspiration for European countries. But the American Heart Association, as we've mentioned, has suggested that at the moment the cost of that and the manpower issues involved with that would be too much. I think what they have, what they haven't said though, is that this shouldn't be done. I think they do think that it can be done, and it's really a logistic issue. For example, at Stanford recently, we've started doing EKG screening of all the athletes with the sports medicine department and the human performance lab there, and we can do that because we have volunteers and because we're in an academic medical center. So the cost to us is much less, and we consider it worthwhile. But to mandate a national screening program is a whole different issue.
Well, it certainly is. And Lila joins us from Phoenix, Arizona, on Sirius, I think. Hi.
Hi. A quick question. My ex-husband, my son's father's sister, died at 35 of sudden cardiac failure from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And my son is 9 now, and he's quite a bit heavy, and I don't know what my challenge is going to be, or if you have any advice as to what I can do.
Let me go to Lisa Salberg on this, who I think probably does have some advice for you.
Yeah, I have a few things. Number one, go to the website, visit us, give us a call. We'll go through it line by line with you on exactly what to do. But as a general...
why don't you give out your website, in fact?
www.hcm.org. That's number four, hcm.org. Now, if you were, this is your sister-in-law or ex-sister-in-law who passed away?
Yeah, my son's father's sister at 35.
Okay. So has dad been screened yet?
Yeah, and they told him, he's also a very large person, and they told him that he had some cardiomyopathy, but whether it was the genetic form that was passed by her, they weren't sure. And
I wish we could do a whole workup. Yeah. We're coming toward the end of the program.
We need to talk, my dear. Give us a call in the office, and we'll go through this. But, yes, please get your son an echocardiogram.
He had one when he was 6, and the doctor said he was too little. He said that he was too young. To
yeah, give him a little more time.
In an HCM family from the ages of 12 to 20, children need EKGs, echoes, and cardiograms every year.
What a good note to end on, because an important one for public health. And thank you all. That is Lisa Salberg, president and founder of HCMA, the association. Also thanks to Joshua Davis and you and Ashley who joined us in studio. Thanks to you, our listeners, and to our producers, Robin Giannatasio Mal and Kevin Guillory. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support for the production of Forum is provided by the Louise and Claude Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation and the members of KQED Public Radio. Additional support for this hour of Forum is provided by the California Healthcare Foundation and calhealthreform.org, a new website for news, insight, and debate about statewide reform at calhealthreform.org.